Now, we wanted our 32nd annual convention to be upbeat because there's really a lot to be upbeat about in the freethought world right now, and that's one of the reasons we invited Phil Zuckerman to speak. He's the associate professor of sociology at Pitzer College in Claremont. He wanted me to open the convention with something upbeat, and we had the pleasure of interviewing Phil on Freethought Radio and reading his book, Society Without God. And Phil will sign copies of his books as they last at the end of the evening. And he'll be here at the book signing table and the books that you can buy over here. And if you haven't bought one already. And you can eat cake and wait in line and get a chance to chat with Phil and see how they do things right in Scandinavia. And we wanted to share the good news that Phil teaches, among other classes, Introduction to Sociology, Atheism, Secularism, and Society. And there's even better news. Forthcoming is Faith No More, How and Why People Reject Religion. That's Oxford University coming out next year. And his book that he edited, Atheism and Secularity, and that's Prager, 2010. Among his many papers and book chapters is the very important chapter, Contemporary Atheism, Numbers and Patterns, and you'll find that in the Cambridge Companion to Atheism. It's an excellent source. And now I had Phil's academic credentials, but I asked him for some more personal touches, so this is what I learned. He says he likes fruit a lot, especially mangoes and apples. His musical tastes are stuck in the 60s and 70s. His wife, Stacy, is a writer and filmmaker and is currently writing a screenplay about Martha Graham. And they have three children, Ruby, 11, who likes to read three books a day and memorize Beatle lyrics. Flora is 8, and she likes to draw and watch Michael Jackson videos on YouTube. And his son, August, is 13, and he likes dinosaurs, Star Wars, elephants, and rhinos. Phil Zuckerman grew up near Santa Monica, California, and his father is a retired professor of Yiddish and English. His mother, get this, is the original surfer girl, Gidget. Her father wrote the Gidget novels based on her adventures in Malibu in the 1950s, so that's pretty interesting. And he has lived in both Israel and Denmark. He prefers Denmark. He enjoys good beer, turkey burgers, and books that debunk religion. So please welcome Phil Zuckerman, who will talk about the goodness of godlessness.
Wow. Thank you. Thanks, Annie Laurie and Dan Barker. What an honor. I've spoken a lot. I speak every day in the classroom, but I've never spoken to a crowd this big, so forgive me if I faint or something. So yes, I was asked very clearly to give a positive, upbeat talk tonight, and I was more than happy to accept that assignment. I think it's good that we celebrate and relish in our godlessness, because let's face it, you know, when you're an atheist, when you're an agnostic or a skeptic, at least in this country, I mean, the world often seems pretty nutty. And I'm not just talking about those LaRouche kids down by Pike's Market. I mean, people just sometimes seem nuts, and it can be weird and freaky. I consider my mother-in-law. A few years ago, the kids were asleep, and she sort of had a nervous energy about her, and finally when my wife, her daughter, went to get ready for bed, take a shower and whatnot, she quickly signaled me to follow her into the kitchen, and she looked very concerned, and she said, I wanted to talk to you while Stacy wasn't present, and I'm really worried. And the look on her face, I thought maybe she was going to announce that she was ill, it was a very serious moment between me and my mother-in-law. We sat down, and she looked me in the eye, and she said, now you know, I have a very generous life insurance policy. I said, uh-oh, what are you getting? She goes, but when the rapture comes, my body is going to float away and you won't be able to get a death certificate, and I just can't sleep at night worrying how Stacy's going to get along. That was weird. And I'm sure many people sitting here have similar stories along those lines. So it is a wacky place, and I think it's easy for us secular folk to fall into kvetching. Most 30 of you probably know or more that kvetching is Yiddish for, you know, to complain, to mope, to whine, to nag, and there's a lot to kvetch about. I mean, the poison of the religious right here in the United States with their talk shows and their radio shows and ceaseless maniacal hatred of presidents who have the satanic temerity to provide health care to poor families. You got the theo-fascist Jews in the Middle East who care more about avoiding cheeseburgers than the human rights of Palestinian children. Muslim fundamentalism wrecking havoc in various parts of the world, endangering freedom of speech, threatening enlightenment, humanism, stoning people to death, and of course seeking to assassinate cartoonists. But worse than all of this, I mean, is simply Michelle Bachmann. It's just, whoo! I get freaked out every time they put her picture on Huffington Post. We could go on and on, and we often do. So I think it was nice that Annie, Laurie, and Dan said, let's focus on the positive. So that's what I'm gonna do tonight. I'm gonna talk about many positives associated with godlessness. The goodness that comes with irreligion, the happy, the joyful. So let's start with oral sex. Most of you look like you're over 21 here. And don't worry, this will have nothing to do with my mother-in-law. Before I get to oral sex without my mother-in-law, let me back up. Just to tell you a little bit about my research trajectory and why I feel competent to talk about the goodness of godlessness. I'm a sociologist, as you probably know by now, and I'm interested in, obviously, various aspects of society and social life and so on and so forth. And of course, one major social force we have to contend with is religion. And a lot of people argue that religion is a good thing. It's good in society. And of course, especially recently, a lot of people have been arguing the opposite, that religion is a bad thing and we ought to not have it. But from my sociological perspective, it's like, well, let's just look and see. Why make a polemical, hypothetical argument? Let's just go out and see what the evidence tells us. Let's compare highly religious societies with highly irreligious societies and see how they're doing. So my latest book, Society Without God, the underlying premise was simply, let's examine two of the least religious countries in the world and possibly in the history of the world, Denmark and Sweden, and see how they're doing. And how the people there experience life. Are they bastions of chaos and corruption or models of societal health and contentment? Are they cauldrons of crime and poverty or are they beacons of human rights, equality, and democracy? Are the people there angry, immoral, and rotten, or are they generally humane, happy, and satisfied with their lot? ABBA fans, of course, know the answer. But you know what I found. I'm sure that I found that, of course, the least religious nations beyond Denmark and Sweden, in terms of standard variables of measuring societal success and well-being, do very, very well. And this discovery started the research ball really rolling for me. So I started to compare the least religious countries with the most religious countries on even more variables and more variables that I could find, looking at more and more studies measuring well-being, prosperity, success, et cetera, et cetera. And then I thought, hey, let's compare the most religious states in America to the least religious states on the same measures and see what we find. And it's been quite a journey, and the result of this ongoing analysis has been the overall finding that godless people and godless societies fare better on almost every sociological measure than religious people or religious societies. Yay. This is too easy a crowd here. Okay, so this is, of course, information to be happy about, to feel good about. So based on my careful study of existing research, I present to you the top 10 good things about being godless. They're not in any particular order, but the point was simply to compile a list of the good news, the good things, the good facts. So as promised, we begin with number 1, atheists experience and enjoy more oral sex than religious people. Of course, you probably already know all this, so I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but I found this out when I was plowing through the plethora of studies on sexual behaviors and comparing religious and non-religious. And to be honest, there actually isn't that much of a significant difference when we compare the sex lives of religious people to nuns. And of course, that's N-O-N-E-S as opposed to N-U-N-S. And just so you know, if you do want to know about the sexual life of N-U-N-S's on your pay-per-view, I think it's channel 28 in your hotel room. But I not that I would know. So in terms of how often, for example, we engage in sexual intercourse, religious and secular Americans are pretty similar. But I did find significant differences on this one topic of oral sex. So here are some of the highlights from many studies, that not only are secular adults more approving of oral sex, but non-religious women are more likely to receive oral sex than religiously affiliated women. Thank you. That's some good news. How do you beat that? Not only are we less guilty about enjoying sex, or not only are we less guilty about fantasizing and so on and so forth, and I'll stop there, but we also practice safer sex. Studies consistently show that secular teens, for example, are much more likely to use appropriate birth control and HIV prevention than religious teens. In fact, I don't know if you all saw this, but there was a recent study, a longitudinal study, on teenagers who took virginity pledges. And they had a nice control group and that did not take those pledges. And they monitored them for, I believe it was 8 or 12 years, and then checked up on them. Both teenagers that didn't take a virginity pledge and teenagers that did had the same rates of premarital sex. But the key difference was the virginity pledgers didn't use condoms. Which comes as no surprise, then, that when we look at the world's developed democracies, STD rates are the lowest among the most secular societies and the highest among the most religious, as are, of course, teen pregnancy rates in the same formation. So, in short, when it comes to godless sex, it's fun and it's safe. Okay, woo! Got that out of the way. Number two, secularity is on the rise here in the United States and in many parts of the world. As recent surveys show, you're going to hear from Barry Cosman tomorrow, his research, as well as Pew surveys, Harris polls, and even a recent Parade magazine, my favorite source of information. People who are distancing themselves from religion are growing significantly. The Parade survey, for example, published just last month, found that 27% of Americans claim to practice, quote, no religion. That's the biggest percentage I've ever seen. I've been monitoring this stuff for years. And 22% said that religion is not a factor in my life. And I don't know if you got that Parade issue. It was just last month. But the story was, you know, the faith of Americans. And as I read the statistics, I thought, wait, what's going on here? And I emailed the author. And about 3 weeks later, she emailed me back. And I said, are these numbers what I think they are? Because if they are, the real story here is this is the biggest, most significant measurement of secularity in America. She said, well, you're right. And I said, well, why'd you title it The Faith of America? Well, it's Parade magazine. So what does this mean with this growth of secularity? Not only are we seeing these numbers in surveys, but there's a boom of college campus activism, a boom in membership to organizations like this. So this means more and more people living life guided by reason rather than faith, more and more people putting their energies into their families, school, work, the environment, and less into worshiping invisible deities, and more oral sex. That's the last time I'll use that joke. I promise. Number three, godless people and secular people are less sexist, less chauvinistic, and much more supportive of women's rights. When it comes to gender equality, atheists and secular people are generally much more progressive than their religious counterparts. Numerous studies over the past 40 years have found that godless people are less likely to endorse conservative or traditional views concerning women's roles, are more likely to support legislation that protects women's rights, more likely to support working women, and more likely to support women's reproductive independence. And when we look internationally, the pattern is undeniably clear, overwhelming, that those countries that have the highest degree of secularity also have the most empowered women, the most women in government, the most women in upper management, in business, etc. So when it comes for the love for and respect of women, whether they be mothers or members of parliament or both, secular culture is where it's at. Number four, we are more tolerant and more accepting of others not like us. It's often said that involvement in a religious community makes for good citizens, that it creates caring individuals. And surely, even we can admit that there are teachings within the great religions about caring for the other, the stranger, the foreigner. I mean, you can find such sentiments if you dig deep enough. Usually in the Bible or the Quran, if you just skip over the passages about how to kill a woman who's not a virgin, or how to behead infidels, or how nations and people who don't worship God or Allah will be doused in lighter fluid and torched by the scorching breath of a demon baby produced by the mating of Ann Coulter and Gary Bauer. if you dig beyond those passages, there's usually some little phrase about caring for the less fortunate, the outcast, the foreigners, the lepers. And yet, when we actually do the social science, we see that it's the secular and the godless among us that exhibit the greatest degrees of tolerance and acceptance towards people different than them. Research over many decades reveals that when compared to their religious peers, atheists and secular folk tend to be markedly less nationalistic, less prejudiced, less racist, less ethnocentric, and less authoritarian. When we look at political tolerance, we find that non-religious Americans are much more likely to support extending civil liberties to dissident groups. And one recent Gallup study found that tolerance of ethnic minorities is strongest in the most secular countries, whereas in the most religious countries, they have higher levels of intolerance for the ethnic minorities in their myths. And this is a classic example of what social science can reveal. The myth is that religion makes us loving and tolerant towards others, and yet the reality is that the strongly religious are often quite intolerant, while the least religious tend to be the most tolerant. So indeed, there's goodness to being godless on many levels, which leads to number five. We're better educated and maybe even a little bit smarter. This is tricky. As someone myself who never did well on tests and was kicked out of high school physics and had to go into earth science where the teacher showed us Ralph Bashke movies, I'm always a little wary of studies that measure intelligence. I mean, who can say what intelligent is? We know there are many ways to be intelligent, many levels to intelligence, many kinds and forms of intelligence, and I think we should always be skeptical of how being smart is defined. That said, numerous studies have at least found that higher education is a strong predictor of agnosticism and atheism, and that being well-educated or having a, quote, intellectual orientation is a significant predictor of apostasy. In my own work right now, I've been studying apostates from all walks of life and from all traditions, and one of the most consistent themes is the notion that even at an early age, they were the ones always questioning the Sunday school teacher. They were the ones always having a hard time reconciling certain things, unlike their peers or siblings even. So there may be something going on there. One of my colleagues, Darren Shirkat, in fact, has found that controlling for so many other important variables, he found that secular men and women score markedly higher on verbal ability tests than religious men and women. And that's even for controlling for educational attainment and race and class and so on and so forth. And furthermore, people who view the Bible as a book of fables have substantially higher levels of verbal sophistication than people who view the Bible as the actual word of God. Among the members of the prestigious United States National Academy of Sciences, only 7% claim to believe in a personal God, and only 8% believe in immortality. Studies correlating high educational attainment and intelligence with secularity have been found in Australia, throughout Europe, and even the Barna Research Group reports that atheists and agnostics are more likely to be college graduates than religious people. So when it comes to educational outcomes, specifically in terms of reading and math skills, scientific literacy, the more secular nations always are at the top. Japan, the UK, South Korea, Finland, and others. Now, granted, these are, undergraduate students in first year psychology or sociology, correlations, not causations. High educational attainment and verbal ability are correlated with secularity, not necessarily caused by it, and we always have to be wary of making simplistic causal conclusions that may be unwarranted. Does secularity cause intelligence, or is it the other way around? Does intelligence cause secularity? We can't always be sure, and in fact, the relationship may be what we call spurious. Maybe both intelligence and secularity are caused by some third variable, like engaging in oral sex. Okay, anyway. I promised. Which leads me to my next point, and I don't know if there was a link or not, but it has to do with homosexuality and the acceptance or enjoyment thereof. Number six, the godless are less homophobic. Concerning the acceptance of homosexuality and support for gay and lesbian rights, atheists and secular folk again stand out as being on the good side of the debates. According to a 2008 survey by the Pew Forum, the unaffiliated Americans, non-religious Americans, are much more likely to support gay marriage. For example, 60% of religiously unaffiliated Americans support gay marriage, compared to only 26% of Protestants and 42% of Catholics. 76% of Americans who never or seldom go to church consider homosexuality morally acceptable, compared to 21% of weekly church attenders. We find similar attitudes when it comes to opinions of AIDS patients, homosexual rights in terms of adoption, artificial insemination, and I'm very proud of this personally. I think it's really good news. It's good news for our children, for our parents, our cousins, our aunts and uncles, and ourselves, as we seem to be able to grasp the radical concept that some people are gay or lesbian. This really just isn't that big of a deal, and is even something to celebrate, as we would celebrate any mature manifestation of human love and attraction. So. I think so too. Number seven, should come as no surprise after all this that we are simply, I don't know how else to say it, we're more moral and we're more ethical. Consider the American invasion of Iraq. Secular Americans stood out on every national survey as being the least supportive of that bogus war. Once the occupation was well underway, when asked, did you think the Iraq war was justified? Again, secular Americans overwhelmingly the least likely to think so. So for example, only 32% of secular Americans felt the Iraq war was justified, compared to 89% of Mormons, 87% of evangelical Christians, 73% of mainline Protestants, and 84% of Catholics. Now granted, this was taken in 2005, so it's a little bit old by now. When it comes to the death penalty, I mean, if there's ever a clear-cut social issue which should reveal the depths of one's moral compass, it's the death penalty. Religions pride themselves. Bill O'Reilly, I remember, said that isn't mercy or a Christian value. I mean, so many religious people talk about mercy and forgiveness as being a hallmark of their belief system. And yet, more religious you are in this country, the more supportive you are of the death penalty, and the less religious you are, the less supportive you are of the death penalty. The general treatment of prisoners. Secular people are much less supportive of retribution and are far more likely to favor rehabilitation. Doctor-assisted suicide. Again, you know where secular people fall. Stem cell research. It's incredible. Incredible. The full 84% of Americans who describe themselves as non-religious support stem cell research, compared to only 55% of Americans who describe themselves as very religious. I have to mention the legalization of marijuana. We are in the Northwest. And you know where secular people fall on that front. How about the governmental use of torture? Recent survey found that secular Americans were the most likely to condemn the governmental use of torture and the audacity of people to suggest that we're immoral. It's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. What about crime? Do atheists and secular people engage in more immoral or criminal behavior than religious people? When it comes to certain so-called victimless crimes like underage alcohol consumption or pot smoking, secular men and women do break the law more than religious people. But when it comes to real crimes, serious or violent crimes, such as some murder, there's simply no evidence suggesting that atheists and secular people are more likely to commit such crimes. And a quick look at America's prisons, bulging prisons, reveals that they are not full of law-breaking atheists. In fact, one study recently found that only 0.2% of prisoners in the USA are atheists, a major underrepresentation of secular people behind bars. Yes. Numerous studies report that when we compare the murder rates and homicide rates of various countries, the pattern's so clear. The least religious nations have lower murder rates than the more religious. And the fact is, concerning violence and criminality, fundamentalist Christians, they shoot doctors. Fundamentalist Jews, they kill Palestinians. Fundamentalist Hindus, they kill Muslims. Fundamentalist Muslims, they behead journalists. And, well, fundamentalist atheists, we tend to behead blueberry bran muffins. And the only things that we tend to kill are hearty pints of microbrews with names like Sleepy Hollow Nut Brown and Dragon's Tooth Stout. Indeed. I'm looking forward to that, too. Number 8, I think we're better parents. But it's just not my opinion. Studies have found that secular parents are more likely to promote independent thinking in their children and to support them in making up their own minds. And this is always tricky for secular parents. We are so aware of the degree to which religious parents indoctrinate their children to believe what they want them to believe, so we're in a little bit of a dilemma. How do we convey our orientation, our values, our beliefs, without mimicking or copying that which we find reprehensible in the brainwashing that goes on in religious socialization? It's not easy. I struggle with it every day with my own kids. But what we do know is this, that studies show that rather than just not teaching religion, we actually do offer positive values, and studies of secular parents that are just now emerging have found that we actually emphasize a very meaningful moral order to our children, emphasizing the value of the pursuit of truth, the importance of questioning everything, the responsibility of being rational when problem solving, and the importance of seeking to do what's best for humanity. And that's just our values. We actually hit our kids a lot less than religious people do. Studies show that when it comes to child abuse, corporal punishment, secular parents are much more humane than their religious counterparts. And of the 17 countries in the world that have legal statutes outlawing the hitting of children, nearly all are among the most secular nations in the world, including the nations of Scandinavia. A UNICEF 2007 report found that the least religious nations on earth are the best countries for the well-being, safety, and healthy life of children. And I think that's when we hear so much about traditional family values, and when the religious right has so hijacked that word, focus on the family, 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 we're the ones doing a better job of raising our children, I believe. Number 9, when there's a lot of us in one place, or in one nation, or one state, or one group, the result is societal success and well-being. And we see this pattern not only when we compare countries or states, but even groups within the same country. Let's take America. Jewish Americans and Asian Americans are the most secular ethnic groups in the United States. African Americans and Latino Americans are the most religious. And we know that on every measure of societal success, Jewish Americans and Asian Americans fare better, on average, than African Americans and Latino Americans. Now, there are surely numerous factors behind this disparity, and it may or may not have anything to do with religion or atheism. But the point still is valid, that religion doesn't seem to be helping the highly religious groups to the degree that we would expect, and the secularity certainly isn't hindering the most irreligious ethnic groups in America. And when we compare nations, as my book is about, again, the least religious fare better on almost every indicator with the possible intersection of suicide. And I say possible because that disappears when we compare states to states in the United States. Based on Cosman's data, you'll meet him tomorrow, the 10 states with the highest proportion of people with no faith, so that's the least religious states, are in descending, well, I don't know, ascending order. Right now, the state with the largest percentage of people with no faith is Oregon. God. Woo! I am a proud duck, number two, the second greatest state in America, Washington State. Followed by, and I'll just quickly go, Vermont, Colorado, Delaware, Idaho, California, New Hampshire, Wyoming, and Montana, in terms of the highest percentage of people with no faith. It's just one indicator. It's not church attendance, it's just faith. Now, the 10 states with the greatest proportion of people claiming to have strong faith are, no booing, North Dakota, South Dakota, South Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, Maine, Texas, North Carolina, and Louisiana. Maine is an outlier, and if you add other variables, Maine will disappear. But just on the faith issue is what I wanted to focus on. And what do we find when we compare these 10 least to 10 most religious states in our country? The highest murder rates tend to be in the highly religious states such as Louisiana and Alabama, and they tend to be lowest among such irreligious states as Vermont and Oregon. The same pattern for other violent crimes such as aggravated assault and so on and so forth. Poverty rates. Again, the states with the highest rates of poverty also tend to be in the Bible Belt. And the lowest rates tend to be in places like New Hampshire. In fact, I found one study that measured which counties had the highest rates of mobile home occupancy. They were all in the faithful parts of the nation. Obesity rates, you can guess. Infant mortality rates. In fact, teen pregnancy rates. The Bible Belt is our country's STD belt, as I mentioned earlier. Whatever the indicator, the least religious states fare better than the most. Now, when I was a kid growing up, there was an ad campaign to get people to drink more milk. And the slogan went, "Milk, it does a body good." With the research that I have just conveyed, I think it tells us the following. Secularity, it does a society good. Wow, and number 10, thank you very much for listening, which you should probably already know, we're just better looking. No, this is true. This is not subjective. I don't know if you've noticed how much sexier we are than the God worshippers, but I base this on my own independent research. So this is not just me combing through, you know, library and computer files. This is my own research. What I did was I took randomly selected pictures of known non-believers and randomly selected photos of known believers, and I made PowerPoint slides, randomly selected, and I showed them to 50 undergraduates at the Claremont Colleges in Southern California. And I labeled them, you know, A or B, and I switched them around a lot, and I had these 50 undergraduates write which picture was the person simply more physically attractive? Who was better looking? The results were astounding. So, you know, the first slide, I mean, it was random sample here. Dan Barker versus Ben Stein. No contest. You should have seen the tallies. Annie Laurie Gaylor versus Beverly LaHaye. It was amazing. The next slide was, this is all random, but Richard Dawkins versus Lee Strobel. It was incredible. The students were just ticking away, and I have the tallies. Ayaan Hirsi Ali versus Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Woo! You should have seen that one. Then I had Sam Harris up against Dinesh D'Souza. Boom! We killed him. Jennifer Michael Hecht versus Kirk Cameron. Woo! Killed. We killed that one. Ron Reagan versus Jeb Bush. is. You can't argue with the numbers. William Lobdell versus Anita Bryant. He's a killer. And finally, Christopher Hitchens against Ann Coulter. Anyone? Yeah! So, in conclusion, from oral sex to educational attainment, from supporting women's rights to not supporting torture, from not committing crimes to loving our kids, from ethics to physical attractiveness, there is deep goodness in godlessness, and we have the social science to prove it. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I think that we have time just for about 5 minutes of questions. And where are the mics? There they are, there and there. But it's going to not a whole lot of time. So keep your questions brief.
Thanks. Sorry, I didn't mean to go over time. I practiced this twice in my hotel room, but I didn't think there would be applause, so I didn't factor that in. So yeah, 5-10 minutes. Yes, sir.
Is this on?
I can.
Okay. And I apologize for my voice. I remember being in a class one day wherein there was a monitor that showed a series of positive thoughts. And I'm a positive person. I like that sort of thing. And one thing that, though, it said was something to the effect that don't take hope away from anybody because that may be all they have. And I it makes some sense to me when that may all be all they have. What would you say to that? Something that make me feel better about maybe helping somebody to maybe see a...
Indeed.
Yeah. Thank you.
My quick response is if religion or these beliefs help people get through their day, helps make them feel better, I have no issue with that. I wish them well, and I wish them strength, and if they can find that in whatever God or whatnot, I just don't want them enforcing it on my government or my kids. But if they want to keep it to themselves, go for it. And in our country, that is often all people have left. I mean, so there's some truth there. Yes, sir.
Another issue that I don't think you brought up is the wealth gap in the more secular societies like the Scandinavian countries versus the United States.
Absolutely.
Where the lower income people might earn 100 or 1/1000th of what the CEOs on Wall Street make, whereas in Scandinavia and most of Europe, it's more like 1 to 20.
Indeed.
And also, I believe in those countries, the more secular countries in Europe, there's a greater amount of charity, a greater percentage given by people.
Indeed.
as well.
Exactly. When we measure income inequality, you're absolutely right. In fact, Denmark has the best Gini coefficient in the world, which is an economic way of measuring inequality. And so absolutely, not only are these countries extremely wealthy, but they're egalitarian with that wealth, which is remarkable. And I think that has a lot to do with why why their religion is not as strong. Because when you have that huge gap between rich and poor, not only does it breed religion, but it breeds crime and a lot of other social problems as well. Okay. Yes, sir.
Yeah, my question is about ritual. Perhaps like yourself, I grew up in a Jewish family.
Did you know I was Jewish? Okay. Just kidding.
Yeah. Imagine that. And when I was 5, I started going to religious preschools or whatever the age was. And then once I got to the age of reason, which for me was about 7, I started asking my parents, well, what's the purpose for all these things and the candles and the this and that? And as they started explaining to me, it sounded like they were telling me kind of Mother Goose rhymes or something, and they didn't really make any sense. And when I started expressing this, they certainly were not supportive of that, but my parents were very much into independent thought, and they said, well, keep asking your questions and so forth. And so my question is, as I've gotten older, I found that I just don't seem to have much of a taste for ritual unless it's something that I came up with myself. There's a few rituals I do that I really enjoy, but in fact, in my family, the only real ritual that everybody participates in is Thanksgiving, because for us, that's an American holiday, and we can all sort of, regardless of religious affiliations or not, get in that. So I was curious if in any of your research you found anything having to do with practicing rituals, the love of rituals, whatever.
I'll make my answer brief because I know we've got our keynote speaker, but yeah, I find that humans actually do like rituals, and there may be a few exceptions. So, you know, you may be the 3 or 4% that is allergic to them. And that's understandable too. I'm allergic to pews. I just can't stand being there. But I actually love rituals, and I engage in them with my family, and I think it's a blast, and it's a way to punctuate important moments in life. So I actually found that a lot of secular people still enjoy rites of passage, life rites of passage, something to punctuate birth, something to the maturity, usually confirmation, bar mitzvahs or whatever. My daughter's having a secular Yiddish bat mitzvah, godless bat mitzvah. So I think you can have ritual without the superstition. But I don't blame you for thinking it's kind of weird, too.
Okay, but there was no correlation between
no,
the religious...
No, not that
okay.
I could find at all.
Thanks.
So one more, Annie? One more in the green hat. Thank you, my Hebrew brother. Yes.
In your scholarly research, have you found any associations or correlations between non-believing atheism and any personality dimensions?
Wow.
Like Myers-Briggs, sensing, thinking, feeling, that kind of thing?
Ooh, okay. Being a sociologist, I'm not as well versed in the psychology literature.
Okay.
And so I have a colleague in Michigan who's helping me get through a lot of that. I don't know it off the top of my head, but there are some significant correlations there. Not necessarily to the author you mentioned, mm-hmm. but in terms of secular people tend to be less dogmatic in their thinking than the religious. Secular people tend to be more difficult time with logical inconsistency and those kind of things that I have seen, indeed.
Okay.
But I'm not an expert enough to give you a good answer.
We'd be a good test population if
indeed,
you want to minister.
Indeed,
I guess you gather some data. This would be the place to do
it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you again. What an honor. Thank you.